supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia police received good grades in their effort to implement reforms mandated by a Justice Department review of the force. Details from WHYY's Tom McDonald.
The Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS, branch of the Justice Department issued a report in 2015 with 48 findings and 91 recommendations, focusing on how officers are trained to use deadly force, department policies, as well as community involvement. The final report shows 91% compliance. Commissioner Richard Ross says that's really good, especially given how tense police-community relations have been nationwide.
We don't do anything in a vacuum. There are a myriad of things that go on while you're trying to do this police reform.
Ron Davis, outgoing head of the COPS program, says he's pleased with the work Philly has done to improve the department.
From what we see a very professional department that is making the kind of continual progress needed. But I think the challenge with that would be is we look at people's perceptions. This is why this is a perpetual goal. There's no finish line. That's going to be based on a lot of things, including generational mistrust, history, experiences outside of Philadelphia, inside Philadelphia, bad experiences that may be aberrant to the 6,600 men and women that serve.
Mayor Jim Kenney says he's not concerned those leading the Justice Department under Donald Trump will upend the reforms.
This is our Philadelphia Police Department. This is our Philadelphia community, and we will police ourselves and improve ourselves and move forward. I mean, I can't imagine any government, any administration telling us to roll back police reforms. I mean, to me, that doesn't make any sense.
Kenney signed an executive order reconstituting the Police Advisory Commission. The commission will consist of 13 members and will pay attention to three main areas: policy review, community outreach, and investigations. The mayor says the commission's budget is growing by $150,000, but he hopes to add to that. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
In 2015, more than 52,000 people died from drug overdoses, with almost two-thirds involving prescription or illegal opioids. The stark numbers are compelling lawmakers across parties to join law enforcement and medical and pharmaceutical interests to help end the epidemic. Let's learn more with Brian Swift, Vice President and Chief Pharmacy Officer at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. Dr. Swift, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Why don't you start off describing your program and your role in it?
My role in it is as the leader of the pharmacy component of our organization to be aware of and to devote resources and efforts towards understanding the opioid crisis and doing our best where we can to address it in the many different directions that we can.
Doctor, how long have you been affiliated with Jefferson?
I've been here over 30 years.
And so the problem was certainly not considered an epidemic during most of your time there.
No, in fact, quite the contrary. You know, we've come from a society that have done our best to escalate attention to pain and recognizing pain and managing it and interacting with our patients to appropriately assess their level of pain and to treat it appropriately, to the point now we realize that, you know, we have to change that conversation somewhat to understand that many patients will have pain, and to be upfront with them and help them understand that, you know, pain may be experienced, but it will be transient. We'll do our best to manage it efficiently and effectively. The recent developments in our state regarding the Pennsylvania Prescription Drug Monitoring Program have helped us a lot in that we have tools at our disposal now, like many other states, in order to better understand what medications were prescribed for our patients and better communication between pharmacists and physicians as to what might be the most appropriate way to treat the pain that they are experiencing at the current time.
Tell me more about these new avails.
Well, Pennsylvania was one of the last states in the country to pass this type of legislation that requires that we have a system in place to register when the patient is prescribed controlled substances and have a system in place so that physicians and pharmacists can have access to this to actually see a history of what has been prescribed for our patients.
If it's too soon to see if that avail has made a difference in Pennsylvania, is there a track record in other states?
Certainly. Other states have already had this in place for quite some time, and they've been able to see the actual impact on better communication and decreased utilization.
What do you find to be some of the easier avails in terms of attaining a short-term success, and then obviously some of the longer-term problems that would take a greater duration to solve?
Well, none of it's easy. In looking at an inventory of different things we can do from the education standpoint, from educating our patients, educating our students, whether they're nursing students, pharmacy students, medical students, the magnitude of this issue, and having dialogue, you know, amongst them to have honest conversations has been great. There's been a pretty robust take-back program throughout the state that are in different police locations and civic associations, but you know, there's a request that just came out recently to pharmacists to get more involved with that and have take-back programs in local pharmacies so that we can help, you know, take some of these medications out of the medicine cabinets of patients' homes and get them out of the reach of our children so that we can make it safer in our own homes. Also, the increased availability of Narcan in our community settings has significantly helped save many patients' lives. So as you can see, it's multifaceted. There's a lot of different efforts that are underway.
Doctor, do you have firsthand experience with the tragedy whereby a patient is legitimately prescribed OxyContin or Vicodin for pain for a duration? The patient becomes addicted. The doctor refuses to continue to write prescriptions. And that patient, in turn, finds that it's cheaper and easier to go to the street and purchase heroin.
I do, unfortunately. And, you know, those kind of experiences really hit home. And, you know, understanding that that's a sequence of events that happens much more easily than one would think is eye-opening.
Do you have realistic cause for optimism in the short run, or is this going to be many, many more years?
I am very optimistic because I think that there are many people out there that really want to make a difference, and there's a lot of smart people out there that have the resources. Unfortunately, I'm also realistic in understanding that there will be many more lives lost before we've actually gotten this under control, but we're at least talking more about it now, and there's more efforts to get it under control.
Well, thank you for joining us to talk about it as well.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Brian Swift, Vice President and Chief Pharmacy Officer at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. President Barack Obama announced yesterday that the United States will no longer extend automatic legal status to Cubans who arrive in the country without a visa. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that Cubans who settled in Pennsylvania have a lot of questions about the change in policy, known as wet foot, dry foot.
Elian Martinez came to the U.S. a couple years ago and settled with Lancaster County's small Cuban community. He says the president's decision took him by surprise.
This is my personal opinion, but I was shocked.
Martinez immigrated through a different program, but he says his thoughts are with Cubans already en route to the U.S. who don't know they won't be welcomed.
How many right now are risking their life at sea? Usually, if they are rafters, it can take, you know, up to 6-7 days to get here. So they don't even know.
Under wet foot, dry foot, any Cuban who made it to U.S. soil was granted what's called parole and put on a fast track for a green card. Now, Cubans who arrive without a visa will have to apply for asylum and prove that they were persecuted to be allowed to stay.
What they're saying online, some Cubans are like, yeah, this is good. What, you know, Cuba's losing all good, young, working-age people.
Sheila Mastropietro directs the Church World Service's Lancaster Refugee Program. She says the group resettled 328 people in that area through wet foot, dry foot last year. That's part of a spike in out-migration following Obama's announcement to normalize relations with Cuba in late 2014. The U.S. says this policy change is the next step in that normalization, to treat Cuba as it does other Latin American countries. But Martinez is concerned about people who try and fail to flee what he says is a repressive regime.
I honestly don't know what's going to happen. Maybe it's going to be harder for those people to get a job, for example.
According to Human Rights Watch, Cuba still shames and sometimes jails people who speak out against the government. And there's another big question. What will President-elect Donald Trump do? In November, Trump said he would, quote, terminate Obama's new friendly relations with the country if the deal didn't change. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Pennsylvania's natural gas pipeline building boom is taking place mostly in rural areas. One of the reasons why representatives from major oil and gas companies were at the farm show in Harrisburg this week. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports they were working largely behind the scenes, trying to connect with farmers.
The farm show can be a noisy place, but this year Pennsylvania's natural gas industry had a fairly quiet presence. Two forums were held about energy industry issues, and although they took place inside the farm show complex, they were sparsely attended and neither appeared on the official schedule. Another thing you didn't see was a photo op of the gas trade group, the Marcellus Shale Coalition, handing out its annual oversized check to the Farm Show Scholarship Foundation. Coalition President Dave Spiegelmeyer says money has been tight lately.
We still remain active, and a number of our companies do support for the farm show, but we haven't had the dollars to spend as a coalition to do major sponsorships.
Low natural gas prices have led to a sharp decline in drilling, and statewide oil and gas companies shed about a third of their workforce over the last couple years. But this is just a temporary lull, according to many in the industry. They say what they really need now is pipelines to move that gas to new markets inside the United States and overseas. It sparked a backlash in some places. Opposition groups have sprouted up, challenging pipeline companies who want to use eminent domain. Phil Stober is an organic farmer in Lebanon County. He spoke out against the proposed Mariner East 2 pipeline, which is designed to move natural gas liquids from western Pennsylvania to an export terminal near Philadelphia.
Why should the people who own some of the finest non-irrigated farmland in the world have it taken by eminent domain, resulting in the destruction of their air, water, and soil by a private multinational oil company selling ethane for plastic production to the Europeans?
Stober was one of about a dozen protesters who gathered outside the farm show complex this week.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Karen Faraday. I'm the founder of Berks Gas Truth.
A few of them went inside to attend a panel discussion on pipelines hosted by the Pennsylvania Grange, where industry representatives were speaking to farmers. And although there were no confrontations, there was a heavy law enforcement presence, with seven state troopers watching over an audience of about 40 people.
Is what energy's role is in our modern, healthy, safe.
Stephanie Wissman was among the panelists. She heads the Pennsylvania division of the American Petroleum Institute, a trade group.
We've been around for several years and have always had a role to play at the farm show. So this year, our participation in the Grange event was our participation here at the farm show.
The message she and others have been delivering to farmers is simple. We want to work with you. But during the question and answer portion, farmers asked about the use of eminent domain and why companies can run pipelines through preserved farmland. Some were also upset that a pipeline crosses their property, but they can't tap into it and use the gas. But Dale Shoup says he's been farming successfully over a pipeline right away for 5 years and considers the gas industry a blessing that's helped save many family farms near his home in Wyoming County.
Farmers that were about ready to go out of business are now in business, and the machinery dealers are making money because they're selling new equipment, and that it's prosperous. And we got to get so we're not relying on foreign fuel.
The second forum was about biosecurity. It was hosted by PennAg Industries and Sunoco Logistics, the company behind the Mariner East 2 pipeline. One of the panelists was Dr. Cheryl Davison from the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She says an avian influenza outbreak in 2015 in the Midwest was devastating and says everyone going onto a farm, whether it's a pipeline contractor or a postal worker, needs to take precautions by cleaning themselves and their gear.
We've lost around the United States, not in Pennsylvania, but around the United States, 48 million birds with billions of dollars of loss.
Kurt Stambaugh is Sunoco's assistant general counsel. He grew up on a farm in Maryland and helped the company develop an online training tool about biosecurity after hearing concerns from farmers.
We realized we needed to be cautious of that, we needed to identify that, and we needed to train our people on it. So that was really the impetus for it.
In fact, fears about an avian flu outbreak kept poultry away from the farm show last year, but the birds were back again this year. Stambaugh says Sunoco intends to share the training widely within the energy industry. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania, at the farm show.
One week out from Inauguration Day, let's get consensus on Donald Trump's transition period with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, what does the public make of this transition time?
What we've asked for the last several presidents is, do you approve or disapprove of handling the transition? Trump's is 44%. That's not great. Obama, same time, back in January of 2009, we said, how is he handling his transition? 83% approved. George W. Bush, back in January of 2001, it was 61%. And Bill Clinton, back in January of 1993, as he prepared to take office, it was 68%. So that approval rating for handling transition for Donald Trump is very low. We think, based on our historical record, that predicts approval rating once he's in office. So, Dave, we'll talk about it, of course, after January the 20th, but this predicts he's going to get a record low job approval rating once he actually takes office, and we start measuring that in the way we've done going back all the way to Franklin Roosevelt.
What's Trump's personal favorable rating?
Well, I don't mean to sound repetitious, but it's the same thing, the lowest in our recorded history, at least since we've been asking this type of favorable rating. 40% favorable rating for Donald Trump at this point among the general American public. And again, Obama had a 78% favorable rating back at this point before he took office. George W. Bush, even though he had been through that controversial recount with Al Gore, had a 62% personal favorable rating. Bill Clinton back in early 1993 had a 66% personal favorable rating. So Trump, again, well below any other president who's coming into office that we have in our Gallup poll records. Interestingly, Dave, 8% favorable rating among Democrats for Trump, highly polarized, as we might expect. But Obama, by way of contrast, had 60% favorable rating among Republicans when he was about to take office. So you can contrast these two presidents.
Frank, as you cite President Obama, what's his current approval for handling the presidency?
He is at 55% approval rating. That's positive for Obama. In fact, that's positive in general across his entire term right now. It's been going up, as we've talked about before, and he's set to leave office with a pretty positive approval rating based on what we've seen for him since January of 2009.
Is there precedent for a recent president whose transition approval was not higher than that of the outgoing president?
There is one exception. Generally speaking, the incoming president does better than the outgoing. The exception to this was George W. Bush. When he took office in January of 2001, he was succeeding Bill Clinton, who had left with a very high approval rating with the dot-com boom and what have you. Despite having been impeached, Clinton had approval ratings in the 60% range as he was leaving office. So that's the exception.
In what regard are Americans most positive about the incoming Trump presidency?
Well, the one thing that he gets credit for is the economy. And when we measure economic confidence, we just finished measuring, is now a good time to find a quality job? A lot of these attitudinal indicators of the economy, like the Dow Jones and the S&P, the overall stock market, are very high right now. So if Trump has a plus in his favor as he enters office, it is these economic expectations on the part of the American public.
Frank, does Gallup take a deeper dive in determining where Americans specifically feel Trump can make a difference in the economy?
The one thing that the public is really, really focused on is infrastructure. Major spending to strengthen the nation's infrastructure, bridges, roads, and schools. 69% of the public says if Trump can follow through on that, that will be very important to them. And by far, that's the highest of anything that we looked at in terms of his promises. Another promise that scores above 50% level in terms of its importance to the average American is reducing income taxes. Americans think that's a good idea as well. Let me go to the bottom of the list, Dave, and this is important. You heard in the press conference that Trump had in the middle of this week that he wants to go forward with that plan to build a wall between the U.S., southern border, and Mexico, but only a quarter of Americans think that it's very important that that actually be fulfilled as far as what Trump has promised. So there's not a lot of interest on the part of the average American in building a wall.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Finally this evening, bench space at Rittenhouse Square may be getting harder to come by. Philadelphia's Department of Parks and Recreation has banned sitting along the 3-foot-high walls of the park. This after residents said too many were using them as a perch to smoke marijuana. Juan Martinez visits the square regularly and says he He shouldn't be banned from the wall just because others are using the site for unsavory behavior.
I grew up here. Like, I feel like this park is known for, you know, it's like the hangout spots where everyone gathers around and it's fun just to be around here. It's just going to push people away. Nobody's going to want to be here.
Signs prohibiting sitting have been posted around the park, and police are asking people to get off the walls as a courtesy. The rule has not yet been codified into city law. Meanwhile, opponents of the wall sitting ban have planned a sit-in house on Tuesday to protest the new rules. Here's advice from the event organizers. Eat your lunch. Look at your phone. Make out with someone. People watch or do whatever you do to enjoy wall sitting. Adding, it's the people's wall. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.